Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. The final exit from Afghanistan is complete, and we are now in a position to look back and forward. My guest today is one of the best people on the planet to do that. Rejoining me on the program is Jim Steinberg. Among many other positions, he served as Deputy Secretary of State in the Obama administration and Deputy National Security Advisor in the Clinton administration. He's currently a university professor of social sciences, international affairs, and law at Syracuse University's Maxwell School. Jim, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, Grant.
Let me just start with something super basic, although it's probably very complicated, and that is the question, why did the mission in Afghanistan ultimately fail?
You know, I think it all depends on how you define failure. I think that a lot of the debate about how to think about this is trying to go back and remember what the objectives were and what the expectations were. And that's why I think there's a lot of controversy about whether this is a failure or not. If you think about this in terms of dealing with the problem of Al-Qaeda, we've had 20 years in which Al-Qaeda, at least the main branch of Al-Qaeda, has been largely neutralized as a threat to the United States. If you think about it more broadly in terms of transforming Afghan society, of course, the results are not as what many people would have hoped.
And on that latter part of what might have been the mission, in that kind of nation building or whatever it is that we want to call it, was that doomed from the start?
I don't think it's a question of it being doomed. I think there was a recognition that once the United States became involved in Afghanistan to try to get rid of Al-Qaeda and to try to prevent Afghanistan from becoming a haven again, the United States assumed a certain degree of responsibility for the consequences of having intervened. And as a result of that, there was simply, if you wanted to keep it from becoming a terrorist haven, it would be better to try to create some degree of stability there. And that was the main effort. It was worth a try, I think. There was certainly a lot of progress that was made, but ultimately whether it could be sustained was the big question. And I think we've seen that that proved very hard to do.
Well, one of the questions that's being asked is why did it take the United States 20 years to get out of Afghanistan once it got in? And what I'm gleaning from some of what you've said already is perhaps the answer to that is to make sure that Al-Qaeda was not there and not operating freely. Is that the answer, or would you add more to that?
I think it's the most important part. I think there was a recognition that if you simply went in and got rid of the immediate threat, but left a vacuum that could be refilled quickly, that a large cost would have been paid with a very limited gain. And so the hope was, in the best case, to create a situation where the stability would be self-sustaining, but at least in the interim, to create a situation where Afghanistan itself was not a threat. And that, I think, really is the biggest question about the decision to withdraw, is whether it might have been possible to sustain that cost for an indefinite period of time if the benefit was simply to keep Afghanistan from becoming a haven for terrorists.
Yeah, I want to get back to that point here in a minute, but let me pursue this first. It sounds like, though, you would agree then with the proposition that we are safer now than we were when we first went into Afghanistan in terms of the threats that might be coming from that country.
I think there's no doubt about that. I think, you know, having served in the Clinton administration and having recognized that once bin Laden relocated to Afghanistan, that we had a very limited ability to disrupt his operations while the Taliban were still in control. And we tried with airstrikes from a distance, and that was not successful. And so we, I think, have certainly dealt with what was at the time the most serious threat to the United States and has kept that at bay for two decades, which is an extraordinary accomplishment. So, yes, I think that's right. Whether that will be sustained in the future, of course, is now the big question.
So given everything that you've said, and it all sounds very reasonable, then I'm puzzled by something, and I've been puzzled by something in recent weeks, and it's the media coverage during the final exit, particularly the extent of the negative framing of that. And I just don't mean Fox. I mean this across the media. But it seems to me that any exit was likely to be messy in the end. And as the president said, the government has been encouraging and helping Americans to leave since last spring. So do you think it deserved the kind of coverage that it got?
I think the problem has been that the specifics and some of the really serious problems with the execution of the end of the U.S. presence has overwhelmed the understanding about the broader context. And I do think that there are operational and tactical mistakes that were made in terms of actually executing the end of the U.S. presence there. But I think it is important to keep the broader question in sight and a recognition that the U.S. had made a commitment to get out. It tried to do it in a way that was not going to undermine the Afghan government. And it faced a great deal of tension between those two goals, because if the United States had focused solely on a quick and complete evacuation, it would have signaled very clearly that the United States did not expect the Ghani government to survive, and it would be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the Biden administration had to try to ride two horses at one time, which is both trying to show some confidence in the Ghani government while also preparing for an evacuation in case things didn't work out.
What were the biggest operational mistakes then, in your view?
I think the problems were setting an artificial deadline for the evacuation rather than making a contingent on a safe evacuation of everyone. There was a commitment to try to get a group of people, both American citizens, people who had visas, and people who'd help the United States out. And it should have been, the departure should have been contingent on that. That's the first. And the second was a failure to worst case the situation and an overly optimistic assessment of the resilience of the Afghan military and the Afghan government, which was certainly the best case from the Biden administration's point of view. But you can't just plan for the best case. You have to plan for the worst case, which was this very quick Taliban takeover.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with former Deputy Secretary of State Jim Steinberg. Well, back to that point about maintaining our presence there and whether there would have been a way to do that, I want to invoke our local member of Congress here, John Katko, and he has criticized the withdrawal itself in addition to the way the final exit took place. He's argued that we should keep troops in many other, we do keep troops in many other countries to maintain a U.S. presence, and that helps protect those populations, and it helps protect us, and it helps keep the peace more generally. And also doing this is necessary in order to gather intelligence. So do you think that's a sound critique on his part?
I think there are some very good points there. I think that the big question was whether the United States could sustain a relatively small military presence in Afghanistan without serious risk to the lives and safety of our soldiers, and therefore get the benefits of our continued presence, which was backup support for the Afghan government and the Afghan military, and an on-the-ground counterterrorism presence. Now, that certainly for the last several years, that had been moderately sustainable. We had not been suffering casualties. Certainly, it cost money, and one shouldn't overlook the fact that there were real resources being put in place. But the hard question to know is whether that could have been sustained over the long term. I think the Biden administration would argue that the reason we had had no casualties in recent years is because of the prospect that we would get out. And if we had turned around, had in effect voided the agreement that President Trump made and said, no, we're staying, whether the Taliban would have increased their direct attacks on U.S. forces and raised the price to the United States of staying. That's hard to know. And I think a lot of the debate about the wisdom of this and the sustainability of staying indefinitely depends on whether we could have done it in a way without putting American lives at risk.
I wonder about the domestic politics of making that change for President Biden had he done that, because that would have put him in a strange situation of saying, look, I'm going to set aside what my predecessor did. And he's been doing a lot of that. And I think it's been supported by large segments of the American public. But on this one, to say, we're going to stay in Afghanistan, we're not getting out. I wonder whether that genie was possible to put back in the bottle. That's probably a poor metaphor, but I think you know what I'm getting at.
You know, I think it's clear that broad segments of the American population believed it was time to get out. And so certainly President Biden was sailing with the wind in carrying out President Trump's commitment to get out. That having been said, the president has a lot of persuasive powers. And if President Biden had been convinced that we were better off staying, I think he could have made the case to the American people that this was a bearable cost and worth the risk. But it seems unlikely given the fact that not only did President Biden inherit this from President Trump, but it had been Senator Biden and Vice President Biden's long-term view that we shouldn't be staying in Afghanistan. So I think the combination of the prior commitment under President Trump and President Biden's own view that the time had come to end our presence, made the other option not a realistic one for this administration.
Mm. And what about the argument that our intelligence is going to be significantly compromised in that country? I mean, can we really conduct intelligence that we need from a distance?
So I think it's hard for anybody outside of government and the intelligence community to make a sound judgment on. Certainly, our ability to collect and use intelligence from a distance has improved dramatically over the last 20 years since 9/11. But whether that capability is adequate to meet this challenge is a big question, which only the people in the intelligence and the counterterrorism community can answer. We've heard the director of CIA indicate that he indicates that he thinks it can be done, although there'll be challenges. And, you know, as I say, it's difficult without access to real knowledge about what those capabilities are today to know. But certainly in the past, we have benefited greatly from being on the ground and having the personal contacts with people on the ground and in present there has certainly been a huge benefit to our intelligence and counterterrorism.
This may be a naive question. Perhaps I've seen too many Matt Damon movies, but it's hard for me to believe that there won't be some Americans operating in Afghanistan either now or in the future.
You know, I you know, that's the kind of thing it's hard to comment on, Grant.
And sure.
There are a lot of things that happen in the shadows, and I just don't want to speculate about what the thinking might be or what the options might be in that respect.
That's understandable. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Jim Steinberg. He's a former Deputy Secretary of State and former Deputy National Security Advisor, and we've been discussing Afghanistan and the impact of the U.S. withdrawal. There is another related criticism to the one that Congressman Katko made in terms of our security, and that's given the Taliban's past record of harboring terrorists, it's likely going to do so again. Can you assess that threat?
You know, you say likely, but I think it's hard to know.
Okay.
There's some possibility the Taliban will decide that its principal goal is to establish an Islamic State in Afghanistan, and that in order to sustain that, it wants to not draw the attention of the rest of the world to disrupt that by allowing terrorists to relocate there. And that's, I think, a possibility. It's also possible that they will feel an ideological affinity to terrorist groups or lack the capacity to keep terrorist groups out. So I think it's just a big unknown at this point. And it's right for other countries to make clear to the Taliban that our willingness to stay out depends on their willingness to make the commitments that they made to President Trump to prevent terrorists from relocating there. And I do think that there's some chance that they will see that in their interest. I think the story of how al-Qaeda relocated had a lot to do with the circumstances that existed in the late 1990s and relationships between Mullah Omar and bin Laden and others coming out of the Afghan Mujahideen. And a lot of water has passed under the bridge since then. The people are different, the relationships are different. Certainly, we've seen that there's a lot of tension between the Taliban, say, and ISIS. I think we should just assume that things are going to go back to the way they were in the 1990s, but we should be wary about the possibility that they might.
So I want to broaden the conversation now and look back a little further and then also forward a little further. And the first thing I wanted to ask you is, it seemed that Vietnam, the experience of the United States in Vietnam, it caused a shift in our thinking about certain kinds of foreign interventions until it didn't. Do you think that this experience is going to have a more lasting effect or a more permanent effect than Vietnam did?
I think it's a great question to raise, because I do think that each generation learns a lesson from their most immediate set of choices and decisions and how well they think they panned out. But then things begin to look different over time. New circumstances emerge, and whether the past is an analogy to the present begins to look very different. And so, I mean, the United States over our entire history has swung back and forth between greater interventionism and greater involvement in the world and greater periods of withdrawal and moving towards more detached engagement of the world. We saw this, you know, before World War I, and then the United States entering into World War I and then pulling back. We saw this, as you say, in the aftermath of Vietnam. So I don't know. I mean, I think it looks more like a pendulum to a historian than moving in one direction. And so I think it will depend on the circumstances and what might call us to get involved again. But certainly in the immediate aftermath of Afghanistan, there will be a certain wariness about further military interventions.
And then I was wondering whether this experience will have some kind of effect on our ability as a country to have a rational dialogue about Iran, for example, about other countries in that region that pose different kinds of threats. Do you think that this is going to poison the waters for being able to see those things clearly?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that each of these circumstances are fairly unique and distinctive. And the key question for any president will be to be able to persuade the American people that a situation emerges that poses a direct threat to the United States that requires the United States to act. And each president will have to frame that in terms of the specific threat and distinguish it from other circumstances where the American people were not persuaded that the need to intervene was compelling. So in the case of Iran or any other potential threat to the United States, it really will depend on the nature of the threat and the ability of the president in office at the time to make the case that that's a threat that has to be dealt with.
And I've heard some commentators link this withdrawal from Afghanistan to our allies in Western Europe and to Israel, for example, and say, all right, now there has to be a fundamental rethinking in those countries about our commitment to support them and protect them and aid in their security. I have to say that strikes me as kind of a bridge too far to make linkages, but I wanted to get your take on that.
I agree with you on that. I really don't think that the challenges in those cases that you've just described look similar either to the American people or to the countries in question. Whether or not we felt the need to stay in Afghanistan is not going to determine whether we feel a need to sustain our commitments to our NATO allies or our East Asian allies or Israel. And I think that each of the cases will look different. And I think that, as I say, both in the United States and abroad, that people understand that you can't simply draw alliances, well, because they got out of Afghanistan, they're not going to be engaged anywhere.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Jim Steinberg. So what do you think is going to be the U.S. interaction with the Taliban government going forward? What's that relationship going to look like?
Again, I think it's hard to know because a lot of it will depend on the form of governance that the Taliban implement, and also how they deal with the potential of the reconstruction of a terrorist threat within Afghanistan. I think that for the Biden administration, for any US administration, there's both the immediate security challenge, which is to make sure that Afghanistan doesn't become a haven again, and the humanitarian concern about the people in Afghanistan. And so I think the nature of the interaction with the Taliban would be one to try to hold them to their words about not letting terrorists relocate into Afghanistan, and then hoping that the both positive and negative inducements of aid and support might temper the Taliban's approach to governing and be more respectful of the rights of its citizens. And it will be difficult, I think, for the United States to have a sustained and more regularized relationship with Taliban unless the Taliban make good in both of those dimensions.
And I assume then what you're placing as contingent there would be, for example, the establishment of an embassy,
reestablishment. I think that, you know, it will be difficult unless the Taliban are rigorous about keeping the terrorist threat out and at least responsive to concerns about human rights, for the United States to have a normal diplomatic relationship with the Taliban.
Well, you have, I think, rightly pointed out all the things we don't know and you know, the inability to make really firm predictions about this. But I am curious, I mean, are you seeing any, it's very early days. I mean, very early days, but are you getting any kind of inkling about things that you're seeing that make you hopeful or give you particular concern?
Again, I hate to be a broken record, but I just think it's too soon to say.
Okay.
The Taliban is struggling to put together a government. There are factions within the Taliban. There are forces both inside in Afghanistan and outside of Afghanistan that are influencing that. And certainly from the outside, I don't have a real insight into the nature of those internal battles as to which of the elements of the Taliban, because they're not a uniform entity, will prevail in the end. I think there are some, I wouldn't use the word moderate, but I think that there are some less extreme elements in the Taliban and some which are more conscious of the need to engage with the broader world and others which are very ideologically extreme. And which ones will prevail are just, I think, too soon to say.
Changing the subject a little bit, I couldn't help but notice that Secretary of State Antony Blinken, he has a very similar resume of prior government service as you do. So how do you think he's doing so far? I mean, he's taking some heat right now, but how's he doing?
You know, I think he brings tremendous experience to the job. He's been involved in international affairs for his entire career. He served in both the Clinton and the Obama administration. And perhaps most importantly, he has a very close relationship with the president. And that's really critical to being an effective Secretary of State. You have to have the ear of the president. You have to make sure that you have every opportunity to have your voice heard and to be able to know what's in the president's mind. And I think he's demonstrated that. I think he's been articulate about the nature of the U.S. interests. He's been engaged, working with our allies. He's shown a lot of energy and commitment under a challenging set of circumstances. And so, you know, it's still early days, but I think his background and experience has shown.
So let's think beyond Afghanistan now. What do you think is the next big foreign policy issue that the Biden administration will have to place its focus on? Is it climate change? Is it China? What is it?
The world is just very complex. And one of the greatest challenges of governing these days is to try to manage all of these things at the same time. There are the known issues on the plate, and then there's the surprises that emerge. We could have, for example, a new crisis in North Korea at any moment, right? The nature of the regime there is such that if they don't feel like they're getting the kind of attention that they want, that we might see a nuclear test or a missile test. It certainly happened before in the early months of a new presidency, so it's not the kind of thing you'd want to rule out. There are the long-term challenges, that the well-known ones, like how to manage the relationship with China and Russia, how to deal with Iran, as you mentioned before, as well as the most pressing issue in many ways of our time, which is COVID, which is hardly over. And it's still having a huge impact on the world in terms of the economy, in terms of security, in terms of human lives. And that still is something that remains to be managed. We have an important summit coming up on climate in Glasgow in just 2 months' time. The Biden administration has made some impressive steps to try to put the United States in the forefront there, but we're not on track to manage this. And anybody who's watched the wildfires and the hurricanes of the last several months knows how critical an issue that is.
You and I are speaking on a Wednesday, and President Biden is going to be making a major address to the country on COVID. So that just underlines your point about that being the first and most immediate issue. You have, though, looked a lot at China. You're an expert in that area of the world. What do you see on the horizon there in terms of our relationship there, our struggle with them? Perhaps China may perceive the withdrawal from Afghanistan as an opening somehow. I don't know. What do you see?
We've heard a lot of talk about people arguing that China will see this as an opening, that we'll see this as an element of U.S. weakness, that we'll try to take advantage of this or try to persuade our friends and partners that the United States is not reliable. But my own sense is quite the opposite. And I have lots of conversations with colleagues in China. And I think it actually, the Chinese reaction on the whole is quite the opposite, that many in China see this as an effort to disengage from Afghanistan to allow the United States to concentrate more directly on competing with China. And that I think many in China see that as the consequence of this withdrawal is an intensification of the competition between the United States and China. And President Biden hinted at this in one of his addresses right after the withdrawal, indicating that that's where he wanted to put his time and energy. So in many ways, I think this could be seen as clearing the decks to concentrate on this competition with China and the difficulties with Russia as well. And so we need to see how the Biden administration will approach this. We have not yet seen the full completion of the Biden administration's China policy review. And so while we've seen hints and some early evidence of the direction that the administration wants to take, we haven't really heard definitively about how it sees the challenge and what's the strategy going to be going forward.
Well, we've only got about a minute left. I wanted to squeeze this last question. And I mentioned climate change. You mentioned the Glasgow summit. In less than a minute, do you have any ideas of the key to unlock the cooperation that is going to be necessary among particularly the industrialized countries to really deal with this, and particularly what the United States can do to change the dialogue? I'm totally flummoxed.
I think this is a great opportunity. I think that there's a growing awareness around the world about the urgency of this threat and a recognition that, one, we have to do something, even if there are short-term costs, and two, that there are potential gains and benefits to be had. And so while it's a big challenge to get everybody on board, if the United States is really going to step out in front on this and take some significant actions, I think it could be a game changer.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. That was Jim Steinberg. Jim, I want to thank you so much for talking with me. And again, as always, when I speak to you, I learn a ton. So thank you very much.
My pleasure, Grant.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, conversations in the public interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher with assistant producer Jacqueline Witwicky. The program is edited by Mark Levonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/campbellconversations.